When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 19 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orczy, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in February 2008. Chapter 19. The Strength of the Weak.
"Monsieur l'Abbé," said Marguerite gravely.
"Yes, mon enfant."
The old man looked up from his breviary and saw Marguerite's great earnest eyes fixed with obvious calm and trust upon him. She had finished her toilette as well as she could, had shaken up and tidied her palliasse, and was now sitting on the edge of it, her hands clasped between her knees. There was something which still puzzled her, and impatient and impulsive as she was, she had watched the Abbé as he calmly went on reading the Latin prayers for the last 5 minutes, and now she could contain her questionings no longer.
"You said just now that they set you to watch over me."
"So they did, my child, so they did," he replied with a sigh, as he quietly closed his book and slipped it back into his pocket.
"Ah, they are very cunning, and we must remember that they have the power.
No doubt," added the old man, with his own quaint philosophy, "no doubt le bon Dieu meant them to have the power, or they would not have it, would they?"
"By they you mean the terrorists and anarchists of France, Monsieur l'Abbé? The Committee of Public Safety who pillage and murder, outrage women and desecrate religion, is that not so?"
"Alas, my child," he sighed.
"And it is they who have set you to watch over me?
I confess I don't understand." She laughed, quite involuntarily indeed, for in spite of the reassurance in her heart, her brain was still in a whirl of passionate anxiety.
"You don't look at all like one of them, Monsieur l'Abbé," she said.
"The good God forbid!" ejaculated the old man, raising protesting hands up toward the very distant, quite invisible sky. "How could I, a humble priest of the Lord, range myself with those who could flout and defy him?
Yet I am a prisoner of the Republic, and you are my jailer, Monsieur l'Abbé."
"Ah, yes," he sighed, "but I am very helpless. This was my cell. I had been here with François and Félicité, my sister's children, you know, innocent lambs whom those fiends would lead to slaughter. Last night," he continued, speaking volubly, "the soldiers came in and dragged François and Félicité out of this room, where, in spite of the danger before us, in spite of what we suffered, we had contrived to be quite happy together. I could read the Mass, and the dear children would say their prayers night and morning at my knee." He paused a while. The unshed tears in his mild blue eyes struggled for freedom now, and one or two flowed slowly down his wrinkled cheek. Marguerite, though heart-sore and full of agonizing sorrow herself, felt her whole noble soul go out to this kind old man, so pathetic, so high and simple-minded in his grief. She said nothing, however, and the Abbé continued after a few seconds' silence. "When the children had gone, they brought you in here, mon enfant, and laid you on the palliasse where Félicité used to sleep. You looked very white and stricken down, like one of God's lambs attacked by the ravening wolf. Your eyes were closed, and you were blissfully unconscious. I was taken before the governor of the prison, and he told me that you would share the cell with me for a time, and that I was to watch you night and day because..." The old man paused again. Evidently what he had to say was very difficult to put into words. He groped in his pockets and brought out a large bandana handkerchief, red and yellow and green, with which he began to mop his moist forehead. The quaver in his voice and the trembling of his hands became more apparent and pronounced.
"Yes, Monsieur l'Abbé, because?" queried Marguerite gently. "They said that if I guarded you well, Félicité and François would be set free," replied the old man after a while, during which he made vigorous efforts to overcome his nervousness, "and that if you escaped, the children and I would be guillotined the very next day." There was silence in the little room now.
The abbé was sitting quite still, clasping his trembling fingers, and Marguerite neither moved nor spoke. What the old man had just said was very slowly finding its way to the innermost cells of her brain. Until her mind had thoroughly grasped the meaning of it all, she could not trust herself to make a single comment. It was some seconds before she fully understood it all, before she realized what it meant, not only to her, but indirectly to her husband. Until now she had not been fully conscious of the enormous wave of hope which almost in spite of herself had risen triumphant above the dull grey sea of her former despair. Only now, when it had been shattered against this deadly rock of almost superhuman devilry and cunning, did she understand what she had hoped, and what she must now completely forswear. No bolts and bars, no fortified towers or inaccessible fortresses could prove so effectual a prison for Marguerite Blakeney as the dictum which morally bound her to her cell. "If you escape, the children and I would be guillotined the very next day." This meant that even if Percy knew, even if he could reach her, he could never set her free, since her safety meant death to two innocent children and to this simple-hearted man. It would require more than the ingenuity of the Scarlet Pimpernel himself to untie this Gordian knot. "I don't mind for myself, of course," the old man went on with gentle philosophy. "I have lived my life. What matters if I die tomorrow, or if I linger on until my earthly span is legitimately run out? I am ready to go home whenever my father calls me. But it is the children, you see. I have to think of them. François is his mother's only son, the breadwinner of the household, a good lad and studious too. And Félicité has always been very delicate. She is blind from birth and— Oh, don't, for pity's sake, don't," moaned Marguerite in an agony of helplessness. "I understand. You need not fear for your children, Monsieur l'Abbé. No harm shall come to them through me." "It is as the good God wills," replied the old man quietly. Then, as Marguerite had once more relapsed into silence, he fumbled for his beads, and his gentle voice began droning the paters and aves, wherein, no doubt, his childlike heart found peace and solace. He understood that the poor woman would not wish to speak. He knew as well as she did the overpowering strength of his helpless appeal. Thus the minutes sped on. The jailer and the captive, tied to one another by the strongest bonds that hand of man could forge, had nothing to say to one another. He, the old priest, imbued with the traditions of his calling, could pray and resign himself to the will of the Almighty. But she was young and ardent and passionate, she loved and was beloved, and an impassable barrier was built up between her and the man she worshipped. A barrier fashioned by the weak hands of children, one of whom was delicate and blind. Outside was air and freedom, reunion with her husband, an agony of happy remorse, a kiss from his dear lips. And trembling held her back from it all, because of François, who was the breadwinner, and of Félicité, who was blind. Mechanically now Marguerite rose again, and like an automaton, lifeless and thoughtless, she began putting the dingy, squalid room to rights. The abbé helped her demolish the improvised screen. With the same gentle delicacy of thought which had caused him to build it up, he refrained from speaking to her now. He would not intrude himself on her grief and her despair. Later on she forced herself to speak again, and asked the old man his name. "My name is Fouquet," he replied, "Jean-Baptiste Marie Fouquet, late parish priest of the Church of St. Joseph, the patron saint of Boulogne." Fouquet? This was l'Abbé Fouquet, the faithful friend and servant of the de Marny family. Marguerite gazed at him with great, questioning eyes. What a wealth of memories crowded in on her mind at sound of that name! Her beautiful home at Richmond, her brilliant array of servants and guests, His Royal Highness at her side, life in free, joyous, happy England. How infinitely remote it now seemed! Her ears were filled with the sound of a voice, drawly and quaint and gentle, a voice and a laugh half shy, wholly mirthful, and oh, so infinitely dear! "I think a little sea voyage in English country air would suit the Abbé Fouquet, my dear, and I only mean to ask him to cross the Channel with me." Oh, the joy and confidence expressed in those words, the daring, the ambition, the pride, and the soft, languorous air of the old-world garden round her then, the passion of his embrace, the heavy scent of late roses and of heliotrope, which caused her to swoon in his arms. And now, a narrow prison cell, and that pathetic, tender little creature there, with trembling hands and tear-dimmed eyes, the most powerful and most relentless jailer which the ferocious cunning of her deadly enemies could possibly have devised. Then she talked to him of Juliette Marny.
The abbé did not know that Mademoiselle de Marny had succeeded in reaching England safely, and was overjoyed to hear it. He recounted to Marguerite the story of the Marny jewels, how he had put them safely away in the crypt of his little church, until the assembly of the convention had ordered the closing of the churches, and placed before every minister of Le Bon Dieu the alternative of apostasy or death. "With me it has only been prison so far," continued the old man simply, "but prison has rendered me just as helpless as the guillotine would have done, for the enemies of Le Bon Dieu have ransacked the Church of St. Joseph and stolen the jewels which I should have guarded with my life." But it was obvious joy for the abbé to talk of Juliette Marny's happiness. Vaguely, in his remote little provincial curé, he had heard of the prowess and daring of the Scarlet Pimpernel, and liked to think that Juliette owed her safety to him. "The good God will reward him and those whom he cares for," added Abbé Fouquet, with that earnest belief in divine interference which seemed so strangely pathetic under these present circumstances. Marguerite sighed, and for the first time in this terrible soul-stirring crisis through which she was passing so bravely, she felt a beneficent moisture in her eyes. The awful tension of her nerves relaxed. She went up to the old man, took his wrinkled hand in hers, and falling on her knees beside him, she eased her overburdened heart in a flood of tears. End of chapter 19. Chapter 20 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orzy, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in February 2008. Chapter 20. Triumph. The day that Citizen Chauvelin's letter was received by the members of the Committee of Public Safety was indeed one of great rejoicing. The Moniteur tells us that in the séance of September 22, 1793, or Vendémiaire 1st of the year 1, it was decreed that 60 prisoners not absolutely proved guilty of treason against the Republic, only suspected, were to be set free. 60! At the mere news of the possible capture of the Scarlet Pimpernel. The committee was inclined to be magnanimous. Ferocity yielded for the moment to the elusive joy of anticipatory triumph. A glorious prize was about to fall into the hands of those who had the welfare of the people at heart. Robespierre and his Decemvirs rejoiced, and 60 persons had cause to rejoice with them. So be it. There were plans evolved already as to national fetes and wholesale pardons when that impudent and meddlesome Englishman at last got his deserts. Wholesale pardons which could easily be rescinded afterwards. Even with those 60 it was a mere respite. Those of Le Salut Public only loosened their hold for a while, were nobly magnanimous for a day, quite prepared to be doubly ferocious the next. In the meanwhile, let us heartily rejoice. The Scarlet Pimpernel is in France, or will be very soon, and on an appointed day he will present himself conveniently to the soldiers of the Republic for capture and for subsequent guillotine. England is at war with us. There is nothing, therefore, further to fear from her. We might hang every Englishman we can lay hands on, and England can do no more than she is doing at the present moment, bombard our ports, bluster and threaten, join hands with Flanders and Austria and Sardinia, and the devil if she choose. Allons, vogue la galère! The Scarlet Pimpernel is perhaps on our shores at this very moment. Our most stinging, most irritating foe is about to be delivered into our hands. Citizen Chauvelin's letter is very categorical. I guarantee to you, Citizen Robespierre, and to the members of the revolutionary government who have entrusted me with the delicate mission—Robespierre's sensuous lips curl into a sarcastic smile. Citizen Chauvelin's pen was very florid in its style. Entrusted me with the delicate mission is hardly the way to describe an order given under penalty of death. But let it pass. That 4 days from this date, at 1 hour after sunset, the man who goes by the mysterious name of the Scarlet Pimpernel will be on the southern ramparts of Boulogne, at the extreme southern corner of the town. 4 days from this date, and Citizen Chauvelin's letter is dated the 19th of September, 1793. "Too much of an aristocrat, Monsieur le Marquis Chauvelin," sneers Merlin the Jacobin. "He does not know that all good citizens had called that date the 28th Fructidor, year one of the Republic." "No matter," retorts Robespierre with impatient frigidity. "Whatever we may call the day, it was 48 hours ago, and in 48 hours more the damned Englishman will have run his head into a noose from which, an I mistake not, he'll not find it easy to extricate himself." "And you believe in Citizen Chauvelin's assertion?" commented Danton with a lazy shrug of the shoulders. "Only because he asks for help from us," quoth Robespierre dryly. "He is sure that the man will be there, but not sure if he can tackle him." But many were inclined to think that Chauvelin's letter was an idle boast.
They knew nothing of the circumstances which had caused that letter to be written. They could not conjecture how it was that the ex-ambassador could be so precise in naming the day and hour when the enemy of France would be at the mercy of those whom he had outraged and flouted. Nevertheless, citizen Chauvelin asks for help, and help must not be denied him. There must be no shadow of blame upon the actions of the Committee of Public Safety. Chauvelin had been weak once, had allowed the prize to slip through his fingers. It must not occur again. He has a wonderful head for devising plans, but he needs a powerful hand to aid him, so that he may not fail again. Collot d'Herbois, just home from Lyon and Tours, is the right man in an emergency like this. Citizen Collot is full of ideas. The inventor of the Noyade is sure to find a means of converting Boulogne into one gigantic prison out of which the mysterious English adventurer will find it impossible to escape. And whilst the deliberations go on, whilst this committee of butchers are busy slaughtering in imagination the game they have not yet succeeded in bringing down, there comes another messenger from citizen Chauvelin. He must have ridden hard on the other one's heels, and something very unexpected and very sudden must have occurred to cause the citizen to send this second note. This time it is curt and to the point. Robespierre unfolds it and reads it to his colleagues. "We have caught the woman, his wife. There may be murder attempted against my person. Send me someone at once who will carry out my instructions in case of my sudden death." Robespierre's lips curl in satisfaction, showing a row of yellowish teeth, long and sharp like the fangs of a wolf. A murmur like unto the snarl of a pack of hyenas rises round the table as Chauvelin's letter is handed round. Everyone has guessed the importance of this preliminary capture. The woman, his wife. Chauvelin evidently thinks much of it, for he anticipates an attempt against his life. Nay, he is quite prepared for it, ready to sacrifice it for the sake of his revenge. Who had accused him of weakness? He only thinks of his duty, not his life. He does not fear for himself, only that the fruits of his skill might be jeopardized through assassination. Well, this English adventurer is capable of any act of desperation to save his wife and himself, and citizen Chauvelin must not be left in the lurch. Thus, citizen Collot d'Herbois is dispatched forthwith to Boulogne to be a helpmeet and counsellor to citizen Chauvelin. Everything that can humanly be devised must be done to keep the woman secure and to set the trap for that elusive Pimpernel. Once he is caught, the whole of France shall rejoice, and Boulogne, who had been instrumental in running the quarry to earth, must be specially privileged on that day. A general amnesty for all prisoners the day the Scarlet Pimpernel is captured. A public holiday and a pardon for all natives of Boulogne who are under sentence of death. They shall be allowed to find their way to the various English boats, trading and smuggling craft, that always lie at anchor in the roads there. The Committee of Public Safety feel amazingly magnanimous towards Boulogne. A proclamation embodying the amnesty and the pardon is at once drawn up and signed by Robespierre and his bloodthirsty Council of Ten. It is entrusted to citizen Collot d'Herbois to be read out at every corner of the ramparts as an inducement to the little town to do its level best. The Englishman and his wife, captured in Boulogne, will both be subsequently brought to Paris, formally tried on a charge of conspiring against the Republic, and guillotined as English spies. But Boulogne shall have the greater glory and shall reap the first and richest reward. And armed with the magnanimous proclamation, the orders for general rejoicings and a grand local fete, armed also with any and every power over the entire city, its municipality, its garrisons, its forts, for himself and his colleague Chauvelin, citizen Collot d'Herbois starts for Boulogne forthwith. Needless to tell him not to let the grass grow under his horse's hoofs. The capture of the Scarlet Pimpernel, though not absolutely an accomplished fact, is nevertheless a practical certainty, and no one rejoices over this great event more than the man who is to be present and see all the fun. Riding and driving, getting what relays of horses or wagons from roadside farms that he can, Collot is not likely to waste much time on the way. It is 157 miles to Boulogne by road, and Collot, burning with ambition to be in at the death, rides or drives as no messenger of good tidings has ever ridden or driven before. He does not stop to eat, but munches chunks of bread and cheese in the recess of the lumbering chaise or wagon that bears him along, whenever his limbs refuse him service and he cannot mount a horse. The chronicles tell us that 24 hours after he left Paris, half dazed with fatigue, but ferocious and eager still, he is borne to the gates of Boulogne by an old cart-horse requisitioned from some distant farm, and which falls down dead at the Porte Gaillole, whilst its rider, with a last effort, loudly clamours for admittance into the town in the name of the Republic. End of chapter 20. Chapter 21 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orzy, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in February 2008. Chapter 21. Suspense. In his memorable interview with Robespierre the day before he left for England, Chauvelin had asked that absolute power be given him, in order that he might carry out the plans for the capture of the Scarlet Pimpernel which he had in his mind. Now that he was back in France, he had no cause to complain that the revolutionary government had grudged him this power for which he had asked. Implicit obedience had followed whenever he had commanded. As soon as he heard that a woman had been arrested in the act of uttering a passport in the name of Céline Dumont, he guessed at once that Marguerite Blakeney had, with characteristic impulse, fallen into the trap which, with the aid of the woman Candeille, he had succeeded in laying for her. He was not the least surprised at that. He knew human nature, feminine nature, far too well, ever to have been in doubt for a moment that Marguerite would follow her husband without calculating either costs or risks. Ye gods, the irony of it all! Had she not been called the cleverest woman in Europe at one time? Chauvelin himself had thus acclaimed her in those olden days, before she and he became such mortal enemies, and when he was one of the many satellites that revolved round brilliant Marguerite St-Just. And tonight, when a sergeant of the town guards brought him news of her capture, he smiled grimly to himself. The cleverest woman in Europe had failed to perceive the trap laid temptingly open for her. Once more she had betrayed her husband into the hands of those who would not let him escape a second time. And now she had done it with her eyes open, with loving, passionate heart which ached for self-sacrifice, and only succeeded in imperilling the loved one more hopelessly than before. The sergeant was waiting for orders. Citizen Chauvelin had come to Boulogne, armed with more full and more autocratic powers than any servant of the new republic had ever been endowed with before. The governor of the town, the captain of the guard, the fort and municipality were all as abject slaves before him. As soon as he had taken possession of the quarters organized for him in the town hall, he had asked for a list of prisoners who, for one cause or another, were being detained pending further investigations. The list was long and contained many names which were not of the slightest interest to Chauvelin. He passed them over impatiently. "To be released at once," he said curtly. He did not want the guard to be burdened with unnecessary duties, nor the prisons of the little seaport town to be inconveniently encumbered. He wanted room, space, air, the force and intelligence of the entire town at his command for the one capture which meant life and revenge to him. A woman, name unknown, found in possession of a forged passport in the name of Céline Dumont, made to the citizeness Désirée Candeille, attempted to land, was interrogated, and failed to give satisfactory explanation of herself, detained in room number 6 of the Gayole prison. This was one of the last names on the list, the only one of any importance to citizen Chauvelin. When he read it, he nearly drove his nails into the palms of his hands, so desperate an effort did he make not to betray before the sergeant, by look or sigh, the exultation which he felt. For a moment he shaded his eyes against the glare of the lamp, but it was not long before he had formulated a plan and was ready to give his orders. He asked for a list of prisoners already detained in the various forts. The name of l'abbé Fouquet, with those of his niece and nephew, attracted his immediate attention. He asked for further information respecting these people, heard that the boy was a widow's only son, the sole supporter of his mother's declining years. The girl was ailing, suffering from incipient phthisis, and was blind. Pardi, the very thing! L'abbé himself, the friend of Juliette Marny, the pathetic personality around which this final adventure of the Scarlet Pimpernel was intended to revolve, and these two young people, his sister's children, one of them blind and ill, the other full of vigour and manhood. Citizen Chauvelin had soon made up his mind. A few quick orders to the sergeant of the guard, and l'abbé Fouquet, weak, helpless and gentle, became the relentless jailer who would guard Marguerite more securely than a whole regiment of loyal soldiers could have done. Then, having dispatched a messenger to the Committee of Public Safety, Chauvelin laid himself down to rest. Fate had not deceived him. He had thought and schemed and planned, and events had shaped themselves exactly as foreseen, and the fact that Marguerite Blakeney was at the present moment a prisoner in his hands was merely the result of his own calculations. As for the Scarlet Pimpernel, Chauvelin could not very well conceive what he would do under these present circumstances. The duel on the southern ramparts had, of course, become a farce, not likely to be enacted now that Marguerite's life was at stake. The daring adventurer was caught in a network at last, from which all his ingenuity, all his wit, his impudence and his amazing luck could never extricate him. And in Chauvelin's mind there was still something more. Revenge was the sweetest emotion his bruised and humbled pride could know. He had not yet tasted its complete, intoxicating joy, but every hour now his cup of delight became more and more full. In a few days it would overflow. In the meanwhile he was content to wait. The hours sped by, and there was no news yet of that elusive Pimpernel. Of Marguerite he knew nothing, save that she was well guarded. The sentry who passed up and down outside room number 6 had heard her voice and that of the Abbé Fouquet in the course of the afternoon. Chauvelin had asked the Committee of Public Safety for aid in his difficult task, but 48 hours at least must elapse before such aid could reach him. 48 hours, during which the hand of an assassin might be lurking for him, and might even reach him ere his vengeance was fully accomplished. That was the only thought which really troubled him. He did not want to die before he had seen the Scarlet Pimpernel, a withered, abject creature, crushed in fame and honour, too debased to find glorification even in death. At this moment he only cared for his life because it was needed for the complete success of his schemes. No one else, he knew, would have that note of personal hatred towards the enemy of France, which was necessary now in order to carry out successfully the plans which he had formed. Robespierre and all the others only desired the destruction of a man who had intrigued against the Reign of Terror, which they had established. His death on the guillotine, even if it were surrounded with the halo of martyrdom, would have satisfied them completely. Chauvelin looked further than that. He hated the man. He had suffered humiliation through him individually. He wished to see him as an object of contempt rather than of pity. And because of the anticipation of this joy, he was careful of his life, and throughout those 2 days which elapsed between the capture of Marguerite and the arrival of Collot d'Herbois at Boulogne, Chauvelin never left his quarters at the Hôtel de Ville, and requisitioned a special escort consisting of proved soldiers of the town guard to attend his every footstep. On the evening of the 22nd, after the arrival of citizen Collot in Boulogne, he gave orders that the woman from number 6 cell be brought before him in the ground floor room of the Fort Gaillol. End of chapter 21. Chapter 22 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in February 2008. Chapter 22. Not Death. 2 days of agonizing suspense, of alternate hope and despair, had told heavily on Marguerite Blakeney. Her courage was still indomitable, her purpose firm and her faith secure, but she was without the slightest vestige of news, entirely shut off from the outside world, left to conjecture, to scheme, to expect and to despond alone. The Abbé Fouquet had tried in his gentle way to be of comfort to her, and she in her turn did her very best not to render his position more cruel than it already was. A message came to him twice during those 48 hours from François and Félicité, a little note scribbled by the boy, or a token sent by the blind girl, to tell the abbé that the children were safe and well, that they would be safe and well so long as the citizeness with the name unknown remained closely guarded by him in room number 6. When these messages came, the old man would sigh and murmur something about the good God, and hope, which perhaps had faintly risen in Marguerite's heart within the last hour or so, would once more sink back into the abyss of uttermost despair. Outside, the monotonous walk of the sentry sounded like the perpetual thud of a hammer beating upon her bruised temples. What's to be done? My God, what's to be done? Where was Percy now? How to reach him? Oh God, grant me light! The one real terror which she felt was that she would go mad. Nay, that she was in a measure mad already. For hours now, or was it days, or years? She had heard nothing save that rhythmic walk of the sentinel, and the kindly tremulous voice of the abbé whispering consolations or murmuring prayers in her ears. She had seen nothing save that prison door, of rough deal, painted a dull grey, with a great old-fashioned lock, and hinges rusty with the damp of ages. She had kept her eyes fixed on that door until they burned and ached with well-nigh intolerable pain. Yet she felt that she could not look elsewhere, lest she missed the golden moment when the bolts would be drawn, and that dull grey door would swing slowly on its rusty hinges. Surely, surely that was the commencement of madness. Yet for Percy's sake, because he might want her, because he might have need of her courage and of her presence of mind, she tried to keep her wits about her. But it was difficult, oh, terribly difficult, especially when the shade of evening began to gather in, and peopled the squalid whitewashed room with innumerable threatening ghouls. Then when the moon came up, a silver ray crept in through the tiny window and struck full upon that grey door, making it look weird and spectral like the entrance to a house of ghosts. Even now, as there was a distinct sound of the pushing of bolts and bars, Marguerite thought that she was the prey of hallucinations. The Abbé Fouquet was sitting in the remote and darkest corner of the room, quietly telling his beads. His serene philosophy and gentle placidity could in no way be disturbed by the opening or shutting of a door, or by the bearer of good or evil tidings. The room now seemed strangely gloomy and cavernous, with those deep black shadows all around, and that white ray of the moon which struck so weirdly on the door. Marguerite shuddered with one of those unaccountable premonitions of something evil about to come, which oft-times assail those who have a nervous and passionate temperament. The door swung slowly open upon its hinges. There was a quick word of command, and the light of a small oil lamp struck full into the gloom. Vaguely Marguerite discerned a group of men, soldiers no doubt, for there was a glint of arms and the suggestion of tricolour cockades and scarves. One of the men was holding the lamp aloft, another took a few steps forward into the room. He turned to Marguerite, entirely ignoring the presence of the old priest, and addressed her peremptorily. "Your presence is desired by the citizen governor," he said curtly. "Stand up and follow me." "Whither am I to go?" she asked. "To where my men will take you. Now then, quick's the word. The citizen governor does not like to wait." At a word of command from him, two more soldiers now entered the room and placed themselves one on each side of Marguerite, who, knowing that resistance was useless, had already risen and was prepared to go. The abbé tried to utter a word of protest and came quickly forward towards Marguerite, but he was summarily and very roughly pushed aside. "Now then, Calotin," said the first soldier with an oath, "this is none of your business. Forward, march!" he added, addressing his men, "and you, citizeness, will find it wiser to come quietly along and not to attempt any tricks with me, or the gag and manacles will have to be used." But Marguerite had no intention of resisting. She was too tired even to wonder as to what they meant to do with her, or whither they were going. She moved as if in a dream, and felt a hope within her that she was being led to death. Summary executions were the order of the day, she knew that, and sighed for this simple solution of the awful problem which had been harassing her these past 2 days. She was being led along a passage, stumbling ever and anon as she walked, for it was but dimly lighted by the same little oil lamp which one of the soldiers was carrying in front, holding it high above his head. Then they went down a narrow flight of stone steps until she and her escort reached a heavy oak door. A halt was ordered at this point, and the man in command of the little party pushed the door open and walked in. Marguerite caught sight of a room beyond, dark and gloomy-looking as was her own prison cell. Somewhere on the left there was obviously a window. She could not see it, but guessed that it was there because the moon struck full upon the floor, ghost-like and spectral, well fitting in with the dream-like state in which Marguerite felt herself to be. In the centre of the room she could discern a table with a chair close beside it, also a couple of tallow candles which flickered in the draught caused, no doubt, by that open window which she could not see. All these little details impressed themselves on Marguerite's mind as she stood there, placidly waiting until she should once more be told to move along. The table, the chair, that unseen window, trivial objects though they were, assumed before her overwrought fancy an utterly disproportionate importance. She caught herself presently counting up the number of boards visible on the floor, and watching the smoke of the tallow candles rising up towards the grimy ceiling. After a few minutes' weary waiting, which seemed endless to Marguerite, there came a short word of command from within, and she was roughly pushed forward into the room by one of the men. The cool air of a late September's evening gently fanned her burning temples. She looked round her, and now perceived that someone was sitting at the table, the other side of the tallow candles, a man with head bent over a bundle of papers and shading his face against the light with his hand. He rose as she approached, and the flickering flame of the candles played weirdly upon the slight, sable-clad figure, illumining the keen, ferret-like face, and throwing fitful gleams across the deep-set eyes and the narrow, cruel mouth. It was Chauvelin. Mechanically, Marguerite took the chair which the soldier drew towards her, ordering her curtly to sit down. She seemed to have but little power to move. Though all her faculties had suddenly become preternaturally alert at sight of this man, whose very life now was spent in doing her the most grievous wrong that one human being can do to another, yet all these faculties were forcefully centred in the one mighty effort not to flinch before him, not to let him see for a moment that she was afraid. She compelled her eyes to look at him fully and squarely, her lips not to tremble, her very heart to stop its wild, excited beating. She felt his keen eyes fixed intently upon her, but more in curiosity than in hatred or satisfied vengeance. When she had sat down he came round the table and moved towards her. When he drew quite near she instinctively recoiled. It had been an almost imperceptible action on her part, and certainly an involuntary one, for she did not wish to betray a single thought or emotion until she knew what he wished to say. But he had noted her movement, a sort of drawing up and stiffening of her whole person as he approached. He seemed pleased to see it, for he smiled sarcastically but with evident satisfaction, and, as if his purpose was now accomplished, he immediately withdrew and went back to his former seat on the other side of the table. After that he ordered the soldiers to go. "But remain at attention outside, you and your men," he added, "ready to enter if I call." It was Marguerite's turn to smile at this obvious sign of a lurking fear on Chauvelin's part, and a line of sarcasm and contempt curled her full lips. The soldiers having obeyed, and the oak door having closed upon them, Marguerite was now alone with the man whom she hated and loathed beyond every living thing on earth. She wondered when he would begin to speak and why he had sent for her, but he seemed in no hurry to begin. Still shading his face with his hand, he was watching her with utmost attention. She, on the other hand, was looking through and beyond him with contemptuous indifference, as if his presence here did not interest her in the least. She would give him no opening for this conversation which he had sought, and which she felt would prove either purposeless or else deeply wounding to her heart and to her pride. She sat, therefore, quite still, with the flickering and yellow light fully illumining her delicate face with its childlike curves and delicate features, the noble straight brow, the great blue eyes and halo of golden hair. "My desire to see you here tonight must seem strange to you, Lady Blakeney," said Chauvelin at last. Then, as she did not reply, he continued, speaking quite gently, almost deferentially, "There are various matters of grave importance which the events of the next 24 hours will reveal to your ladyship, and believe me that I am actuated by motives of pure friendship towards you in this my effort to mitigate the unpleasantness of such news, as you might hear to-morrow, perhaps, by giving you due warning of what its nature might be." She turned great questioning eyes upon him, and in their expression she tried to put all the contempt which she felt, all the bitterness, all the defiance and the pride. He quietly shrugged his shoulders. "Ah, I fear me," he said, "that your ladyship, as usual, doth me grievous wrong. It is but natural that you should misjudge me. Yet believe me..." "A truce on this foolery, Monsieur Chauvelin," she broke in, with sudden impatient vehemence. "Pray leave your protestations of friendship and courtesy alone. There is no one here to hear them. I pray proceed with what you have to say." "Ah!" It was a sigh of satisfaction on the part of Chauvelin. Her anger and impatience, even at this early stage of the interview, proved sufficiently that her icy restraint was only on the surface. And Chauvelin always knew how to deal with vehemence. He loved to play with the emotions of a passionate fellow creature. It was only the imperturbable calm of a certain enemy of his that was wont to shake his own impenetrable armour of reserve. "As your ladyship desires," he said, with a slight and ironical bow of the head. "But before proceeding according to your wish, I am compelled to ask your ladyship just one question." "And that is?" "Have you reflected what your present position means to that inimitable prince of dandies, Sir Percy Blakeney? Is it necessary for your present purpose, monsieur, that you should mention my husband's name at all?" she asked. "It is indispensable, fair lady," he replied suavely. "For is not the fate of your husband so closely intertwined with yours that his actions will inevitably be largely influenced by your own?" Marguerite gave a start of surprise, and as Chauvelin had paused, she tried to read what hidden meaning lay behind these last words of his. Was it his intention, then, to propose some bargain, one of those terrible either-ors of which he seemed to possess the malignant secret? Oh, if that was so, if indeed he had sent for her in order to suggest one of those terrible alternatives of his, then, be it what it may, be it the wildest conception which the insane brain of a fiend could invent, she would accept it, so long as the man she loved were given one single chance of escape. Therefore she turned to her arch-enemy in a more conciliatory spirit now, and even endeavoured to match her own diplomatic cunning against his. "I do not understand," she said tentatively. "How can my actions influence those of my husband? I am a prisoner in Boulogne. He probably is not aware of that fact yet, and..." "Sir Percy Blakeney may be in Boulogne at any moment now," he interrupted quietly. "And I mistake not, few places can offer such great attractions to that peerless gentleman of fashion than doth this humble provincial town of France just at this present. Hath it not the honour of harbouring Lady Blakeney within its gates? And your ladyship may indeed believe me when I say that the day that Sir Percy lands in our hospitable port, 200 pairs of eyes will be fixed upon him, lest he should wish to quit it again." "And if it were 2,000, sir," she said impulsively, "they would not stop his coming or going as he pleased." "Nay, fair lady," he said with a smile, "are you then endowing Sir Percy Blakeney with the attributes which, as popular fancy has it, belong exclusively to that mysterious English hero, the Scarlet Pimpernel?" "A truce to your diplomacy, Monsieur Chauvelin," she retorted, goaded by his sarcasm. "Why should we try to fence with one another? What was the object of your journey to England? Of the farce which you enacted in my house with the help of the woman Candet, of that duel and that challenge, save that you desired to entice Sir Percy Blakeney to France?
"And also his charming wife," he added with an ironical bow. She bit her lip and made no comment. "Shall we say that I succeeded admirably," he continued, speaking with persistent urbanity and calm, "and that I have strong cause to hope that the elusive Pimpernel will soon be a guest on our friendly shores? There, you see, I too have laid down the foils. As you say, why should we fence? Your ladyship is now in Boulogne. Soon Sir Percy will come to try and take you away from us, but believe me, fair lady, that it would take more than the ingenuity and the daring of the Scarlet Pimpernel magnified a thousandfold to get him back to England again. Unless..." Marguerite held her breath. She felt now as if the whole universe must stand still during the next supreme moment, until she had heard what Chauvelin's next words would be. There was to be an unless, then? An either-or more terrible, no doubt, than the one he had formulated before her just a year ago. Chauvelin, she knew, was past master in the art of putting a knife at his victim's throat, and of giving it just the necessary twist with his cruel and relentless unless. But she felt quite calm, because her purpose was resolute. There is no doubt that during this agonizing moment of suspense she was absolutely firm in her determination to accept any and every condition which Chauvelin would put before her as the price of her husband's safety. After all, these conditions, since he placed them before her, could resolve themselves into questions of her own life against her husband's. With that unreasoning impulse which was one of her most salient characteristics, she never paused to think that, to Chauvelin, her own life and death were only the means to the great end which he had in view, the complete annihilation of the Scarlet Pimpernel. That end could only be reached by Percy Blakeney's death, not by her own. Even now, as she was watching him with eyes glowing and lips tightly closed, lest a cry of impatient agony should escape her throat, he, like a snail that has shown its slimy horns too soon and is not ready to face the enemy as yet, seemed suddenly to withdraw within his former shell of careless suavity. The earnestness of his tone vanished, giving place to light and easy conversation, just as if he were discussing social topics with a woman of fashion in a Paris drawing-room. "Nay," he said pleasantly, "is not your ladyship taking this matter in too serious a spirit? Of a truth you repeated my innocent word unless, even as if I were putting a knife at your dainty throat. Yet I meant naught that need disturb you yet. Have I not said that I am your friend? Let me try and prove it to you." "You will find that a difficult task, monsieur," she said dryly. "Difficult tasks always have had a great fascination for your humble servant. May I try?" "Certainly." "Shall we then touch at the root of this delicate matter? Your ladyship, so I understand, is at this moment under the impression that I desire to encompass, shall I say, the death of an English gentleman for whom, believe me, I have the greatest respect. That is so, is it not?" "What is so, Monsieur Chauvelin?" she asked almost stupidly, for truly she had not even begun to grasp his meaning. "I do not understand." "You think that I am at this moment taking measures for sending the Scarlet Pimpernel to the guillotine, eh?"
"I do."
"Never was so great an error committed by a clever woman. Your ladyship must believe me when I say that the guillotine is the very last place in the world where I would wish to see that enigmatic and elusive personage."
"Are you trying to fool me, Monsieur Chauvelin? If so, for what purpose? And why do you lie to me like that?"
"On my honour, 'tis the truth. The death of Sir Percy Blakeney, I may call him that, may I not, would ill suit the purpose which I have in view."
"What purpose? You must pardon me, Monsieur Chauvelin," she added with a quick, impatient sigh, "but of a truth I am getting confused, and my wits must have become dull in the past few days. I pray to you to add to your many protestations of friendship a little more clearness in your speech, and, if possible, a little more brevity. What, then, is the purpose which you had in view when you enticed my husband to come over to France?"
"My purpose was the destruction of the Scarlet Pimpernel, not the death of Sir Percy Blakeney. Believe me, I have a great regard for Sir Percy. He is a most accomplished gentleman, witty, brilliant, an inimitable dandy. Why should he not grace with his presence the drawing-rooms of London or of Brighton for many years to come?" She looked at him with puzzled inquiry. For one moment the thought flashed through her mind that, after all, Chauvelin might be still in doubt as to the identity of the Scarlet Pimpernel. But no, that hope was madness. It was preposterous and impossible. But then why? 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 Oh, God, for a little more patience!
"What I have just said may seem a little enigmatic to your ladyship," he continued blandly, "but surely so clever a woman as yourself, so great a lady as is the wife of Sir Percy Blakeney, Baronet, will be aware that there are other means of destroying an enemy than the taking of his life."
"For instance, Monsieur Chauvelin?"
"There is the destruction of his honour," he replied slowly. A long, bitter laugh, almost hysterical in its loud outburst, broke from the very depths of Marguerite's convulsed heart.
The destruction of his honour! Of a truth, Monsieur Chauvelin, your inventive powers have led you beyond the bounds of dreamland! It is in the land of madness that you are wandering, sir, when you talk in one breath of Sir Percy Blakeney and the possible destruction of his honour.
But he remained apparently quite unruffled, and when her laughter had somewhat subsided, he said placidly, "Perhaps." Then he rose from his chair and once more approached her. This time she did not shrink from him. The suggestion which he had made just now, this talk of attacking her husband's honour rather than his life, seemed so wild and preposterous, the conception truly of a mind unhinged, that she looked upon it as a sign of extreme weakness on his part, almost as an acknowledgment of impotence. But she watched him as he moved round the table more in curiosity now than in fright. He puzzled her, and she still had a feeling at the back of her mind that there must be something more definite and more evil lurking at the back of that torturous brain. "Will your ladyship allow me to conduct you to yonder window?" he said. "The air is cool, and what I have to say can best be done in sight of yonder sleeping city." His tone was one of perfect courtesy, even of respectful deference, through which not the slightest trace of sarcasm could be discerned, and she, still actuated by curiosity and interest, not in any way by fear, quietly rose to obey him. Though she ignored the hand which he was holding out towards her, she followed him readily enough as he walked up to the window. All through this agonizing and soul-stirring interview she had felt heavily oppressed by the close atmosphere of the room, rendered nauseous by the evil smell of the smoky tallow candles which were left to spread their grease and smoke abroad unchecked. Once or twice she had gazed longingly towards the suggestion of pure air outside. Chauvelin evidently still had much to say to her. The torturing mental rack to which she was being subjected had not yet fully done its work. It still was capable of one or two turns, a twist or so, which might succeed in crushing her pride and her defiance. Well, so be it. She was in the man's power, had placed herself therein through her own unreasoning impulse. This interview was but one of the many soul agonies which she had been called upon to endure, and if by submitting to it all she could in a measure mitigate her own faults and be of help to the man she loved, she would find the sacrifice small and the mental torture easy to bear. Therefore, when Chauvelin beckoned to her to draw near, she went up to the window, and leaning her head against the deep stone embrasure, she looked out into the night. End of chapter 22. Chapter 23 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in February 2008. Chapter 23. The Hostage. Chauvelin, without speaking, extended his hand out towards the city, as if to invite Marguerite to gaze upon it. She was quite unconscious what hour of the night it might be, but it must have been late, for the little town, encircled by the stony arms of its forts, seemed asleep. The moon, now slowly sinking in the west, edged the towers and spires with filmy lines of silver. To the right, Marguerite caught sight of the frowning Beffroi, which, even as she gazed out, began tolling its heavy bell. It sounded like the tocsin, dull and muffled. After 10 strokes it was still. 10 o'clock. At this hour, in far-off England, in fashionable London, the play was just over. Crowds of gaily dressed men and women poured out of the open gates of the theatres, calling loudly for attendant or chaise. Thence to balls or routs, gaily fluttering like so many butterflies, brilliant and irresponsible. And in England also, in the beautiful gardens of her Richmond home, oft-times at 10 o'clock she had wandered alone with Percy when he was at home, and the spirit of adventure in him momentarily lay to rest. Then, when the night was very dark and the air heavy with the scent of roses and lilies, she lay quiescent in his arms, in that little arbour beside the river. The rhythmic lapping of the waves was the only sound that stirred the balmy air. He seldom spoke then, for his voice would shake whenever he uttered a word, but his impenetrable armour of flippancy was pierced through, and he did not speak because his lips were pressed to hers and his love had soared beyond the domain of speech. A shudder of intense mental pain went through her now as she gazed on the sleeping city, and sweet memories of the past turned to bitterness in this agonizing present. One by one, as the moon gradually disappeared behind a bank of clouds, the towers of Boulogne were merged in the gloom. In front of her, far, far away, beyond the flat sand dunes, the sea seemed to be calling to her with a ghostly and melancholy moan. The window was on the ground floor of a fort, and gave direct onto the wide and shady walk which runs along the crest of the city walls. From where she stood, Marguerite was looking straight along the ramparts, some 30 meters wide at this point, flanked on either side by the granite balustrade, and adorned with a double row of ancient elms, stunted and twisted into grotesque shapes by the persistent action of the wind. "These wide ramparts are a peculiarity of this city," said a voice close to her ear. "At times of peace they form an agreeable promenade under the shade of the trees, and a delightful meeting-place for lovers, or enemies." The sound brought her back to the ugly realities of the present. The rose-scented garden at Richmond, the lazily flowing river, the tender memories which for that brief moment had confronted her from out of a happy past, suddenly vanished from her ken. Instead of these, the brine-laden sea-air struck her quivering nostrils. The echo of the old beffroi died away in her ear, and now from out one of the streets or open places of the sleeping city there came the sound of a raucous voice, shouting in monotonous tones a string of words, the meaning of which failed to reach her brain. Not many feet below the window the southern ramparts of the town stretched away into the darkness. She felt unaccountably cold suddenly as she looked down upon them, and with aching eyes tried to pierce the gloom. She was shivering in spite of the mildness of this early autumnal night. Her overwrought fancy was peopling the lonely walls with unearthly shapes strolling along, discussing in spectral language a strange duel which was to take place here between a noted butcher of men and a mad Englishman overfond of adventure. The ghouls seemed to pass and repass along in front of her, and to be laughing audibly because that mad Englishman had been offered his life in exchange for his honour. They laughed and laughed, no doubt because he refused the bargain. Englishmen were always eccentric, and in these days of equality and other devices of a free and glorious revolution, honour was such a very marketable commodity that it seemed ridiculous to prize it quite so highly. Then they strolled away again and disappeared, whilst Marguerite distinctly heard the scrunching of the path beneath their feet. She leant forward to peer still further into the darkness, for this sound had seemed so absolutely real, but immediately a detaining hand was placed upon her arm, and a sarcastic voice murmured at her elbow, "The result, fair lady, would only be a broken leg or arm. The height is not great enough for picturesque suicides, and believe me, these ramparts are only haunted by ghosts." She drew back as if a viper had stung her. For the moment she had become oblivious of Chauvelin's presence. However, she would not take notices of his taunt, and after a slight pause he asked her if she could hear the town crier over in the public streets. "Yes," she replied. "What he says at this present moment is of vast importance to your ladyship," he remarked dryly. "How so?" "Your ladyship is a precious hostage. We are taking measures to guard our valuable property securely." Marguerite thought of the Abbé Fouquet, who no doubt was still quietly telling his beads, even if in his heart he had begun to wonder what had become of her. She thought of François, who was the breadwinner, and of Félicité, who was blind. "Methinks you and your colleagues have done that already," she said. "Not as completely as we would wish. We know the daring of the Scarlet Pimpernel. We are not even ashamed to admit that we fear his luck, his impudence, and his marvellous ingenuity. Have I not told you that I have the greatest possible respect for that mysterious English hero? An old priest and two young children might be spirited away by that enigmatical adventurer, even whilst Lady Blakeney herself is made to vanish from our sight." "Ha! I see your ladyship is taking my simple words as a confession of weakness," he continued, noting the swift sigh of hope which had involuntarily escaped her lips. "Nay, an it please you, you shall despise me for it. But a confession of weakness is the first sign of strength. The Scarlet Pimpernel is still at large, and whilst we guard our hostage securely, he is bound to fall into our hands." "Aye, still at large," she retorted with impulsive defiance. "Think you that all your bolts and bars, the ingenuity of yourself and your colleagues, the collaboration of the devil himself, would succeed in outwitting the Scarlet Pimpernel, now that his purpose will be to try to drag me from out of your clutches?" She felt hopeful and proud. Now that she had the pure air of heaven in her lungs, that from afar she could smell the sea, and could feel that perhaps in a straight line of vision from where she stood the Daydream, with Sir Percy on board, might be lying out there in the roads, it seemed impossible that he should fail in freeing her and those poor people, an old man and two children whose lives depended on her own. But Chauvelin only laughed a dry, sarcastic laugh, and said, "Perhaps not. It of course will depend on you and your personality, your feelings in such matters, and whether an English gentleman likes to save his own skin at the expense of others." Marguerite shivered as if from cold. "Ah, I see," resumed Chauvelin quietly, "that your ladyship has not quite grasped the position. That public crier is a long way off. The words have lingered on the evening breeze, and have failed to reach your brain. Do you suppose that I and my colleagues do not know that all the ingenuity of which the Scarlet Pimpernel is capable will now be directed in piloting Lady Blakeney, and incidentally the Abbé Fouquet, with his nephew and niece, safely across the Channel? Four people. Bah! A bagatelle for this mighty conspirator, who but lately snatched 20 aristocrats from the prisons of Lyon. Nay, nay, two children and an old man were not enough to guard our precious hostage, and I was not thinking of either the Abbé Fouquet or of the two children when I said that an English gentleman would not save himself at the expense of others. Of whom are you then thinking, Monsieur Chauvelin? Whom else have you set to guard the prize which you value so highly? The whole city of Boulogne, he replied simply. I do not understand. Let me make my point clear. My colleague, citizen Collot d'Herbois, rode over from Paris yesterday. Like myself, he is a member of the Committee of Public Safety, whose duty it is to look after the welfare of France by punishing all those who conspire against her laws and the liberties of the people. Chief among these conspirators, whom it is our duty to punish, is, of course, that impudent adventurer who calls himself the Scarlet Pimpernel. He has given the government of France a great deal of trouble through his attempts, mostly successful, as I have already admitted, at frustrating the just vengeance which an oppressed country has the right to wreak on those who have proved themselves to be tyrants and traitors. Is it necessary to recapitulate all this, Monsieur Chauvelin? She asked impatiently.
I think so, he replied blandly. You see, my point is this. We feel that in a measure now the Scarlet Pimpernel is in our power. Within the next few hours he will land at Boulogne, Boulogne, where he has agreed to fight a duel with me, Boulogne, where Lady Blakeney happens to be at this present moment. As you see, Boulogne has a great responsibility to bear. Just now she is to a certain extent the proudest city in France, since she holds within her gates a hostage for the appearance on our shores of her country's most bitter enemy. But she must not fall from that high estate. Her double duty is clear before her. She must guard Lady Blakeney and capture the Scarlet Pimpernel. If she fail in the former, she must be punished. If she succeed in the latter, she shall be rewarded. He paused and leaned out of the window again, whilst she watched him, breathless and terrified. She was beginning to understand. "Hark," he said, looking straight at her. "Do you hear the crier now? He is proclaiming the punishment and the reward. He is making it clear to the citizens of Boulogne that on the day when the Scarlet Pimpernel falls into the hands of the Committee of Public Safety, a general amnesty will be granted to all natives of Boulogne who are under arrest at the present time, and a free pardon to all those who, born within these city walls, are today under sentence of death. A noble reward, eh? Well deserved, you'll admit. Should you wonder, then, if the whole town of Boulogne were engaged just now in finding that mysterious hero, and delivering him into our hands? How many mothers, sisters, wives, think you, at the present moment, would fail to lay hands on the English adventurer if a husband's or a son's life or freedom happened to be at stake? I have some records there," he continued, pointing in the direction of the table, "which tell me that there are 35 natives of Boulogne in the local prisons, a dozen more in the prisons of Paris. Of these, at least 20 have been tried already and are condemned to death. Every hour that the Scarlet Pimpernel succeeds in evading his captors, so many deaths lie at his door. If he succeeds in once more reaching England safely, 70 lives, mayhap, will be the price of his escape. Nay, but I see your ladyship is shivering with cold," he added with a dry little laugh. "Shall I close the window, or do you wish to hear what punishment will be meted out to Boulogne if on the day that the Scarlet Pimpernel is captured Lady Blakeney happens to have left the shelter of these city walls?" "I pray you proceed, monsieur," she rejoined with perfect calm. "The Committee of Public Safety," he resumed, "would look upon this city as a nest of traitors if on the day that the Scarlet Pimpernel becomes our prisoner, Lady Blakeney herself, the wife of that notorious English spy, had already quitted Boulogne. The whole town knows by now that you are in our hands, you, the most precious hostage we can hold for the ultimate capture of the man whom we all fear and detest. Virtually the town crier is at the present moment proclaiming to the inhabitants of this city, 'We want that man, but we already have his wife. See to it, citizens, that she does not escape. For if she do, we shall summarily shoot the breadwinner in every family in the town.'" A cry of horror escaped Marguerite's parched lips. "Are you devils, then, all of you?" she gasped, "that you should think of such things?"
"Aye, some of us are devils, no doubt," said Chauvelin dryly. "But why should you honour us in this case with so flattering an epithet? We are mere men striving to guard our property, and mean no harm to the citizens of Boulogne. We have threatened them, true.
But is it not for you and that elusive Pimpernel to see that the threat is never put into execution?" "You would not do it," she repeated, horror-stricken. "Nay, I pray you, fair lady, do not deceive yourself. At present the proclamation sounds like a mere threat, I'll allow, but let me assure you that if we fail to capture the Scarlet Pimpernel, and if you, on the other hand, are spirited out of this fortress by that mysterious adventurer, we shall undoubtedly shoot or guillotine every able-bodied man and woman in this town."
He had spoken quietly and emphatically, neither with bombast nor with rage, and Marguerite saw in his face nothing but a calm and ferocious determination, the determination of an entire nation embodied in this one man, to be revenged at any cost. She would not let him see the depth of her despair, nor would she let him read in her face the unutterable hopelessness which filled her soul. It were useless to make an appeal to him. She knew full well that from him she could obtain neither gentleness nor mercy. "I hope at last I have made the situation quite clear to your ladyship," he was asking quite pleasantly now. "See how easy is your position. You have but to remain quiescent in room number 6, and if any chance of escape be offered you ere the Scarlet Pimpernel is captured, you need but to think of all the families of Boulogne who would be deprived of their breadwinner, fathers and sons mostly, but there are girls too who support their mothers or sisters. The fish-curers of Boulogne are mostly women, and there are the net-makers and the seamstresses. All would suffer if your ladyship were no longer to be found in number 6 room of this ancient fort, whilst all would be included in the amnesty if the Scarlet Pimpernel fell into our hands." He gave a low, satisfied chuckle, which made Marguerite think of the evil spirits in hell exulting over the torments of unhappy lost souls. "I think, Lady Blakeney," he added dryly and making her an ironical bow, "that your humble servant hath outwitted the elusive hero at last." Quietly he turned on his heel and went back into the room, Marguerite remaining motionless beside the open window, where the soft, brine-laden air, the distant murmur of the sea, the occasional cry of a sea-mew, all seemed to mock her agonizing despair. The voice of the town crier came nearer and nearer now. She could hear the words he spoke quite distinctly, something about amnesty and pardon, the reward for the capture of the Scarlet Pimpernel, the lives of men, women, and children in exchange for his. Oh, she knew what all that meant, that Percy would not hesitate one single instant to throw his life into the hands of his enemies in exchange for that of others. Others, others, always others! This sigh that had made her heart ache so often in England, what terrible significance it bore now! And now he would suffer in his heart and in his pride, because of her whom he could not even attempt to save, since it would mean the death of others. Of others, always of others! She wondered if he had already landed in Boulogne. Again she remembered the vision on the landing stage, his massive figure, the glimpse she had of the loved form in the midst of the crowd. The moment he entered the town he would hear the proclamation read, see it posted up, no doubt, on every public building, and realize that she had been foolish enough to follow him, that she was a prisoner, and that he could do nothing to save her. What would he do? Marguerite, at the thought, instinctively pressed her hands to her heart. The agony of it all had become physically painful. She hoped that perhaps this pain meant approaching death. Oh, how easy would this simple solution be! The moon peered out from beneath the bank of clouds which had obscured her for so long. Smiling, she drew her pencilled silver lines along the edge of towers and pinnacles, the frowning beffroi and those stony walls which seemed to Marguerite as if they encircled a gigantic graveyard. The town crier had evidently ceased to read the proclamation. One by one the windows in the public square were lighted up from within. The citizens of Boulogne wanted to think over the strange events which had occurred without their knowledge, yet which were apparently to have such direful or joyous consequences for them. A man to be captured, the mysterious English adventurer of whom they had all heard but whom nobody had seen, and a woman, his wife, to be guarded until the man was safely under lock and key. Marguerite felt as if she could almost hear them talking it over, and vowing that she should not escape, and that the Scarlet Pimpernel should soon be captured. A gentle wind stirred the old gnarled trees on the southern ramparts, a wind that sounded like the sigh of swiftly dying hope. What could Percy do now? His hands were tied, and he was inevitably destined to endure the awful agony of seeing the woman he loved die a terrible death beside him. Having captured him, they would not keep him long. No necessity for a trial, for detention, for formalities of any kind. A summary execution at dawn on the public place, a roll of drums, a public holiday to mark the joyful event, and a brave man will have ceased to live, a noble heart have stilled its beatings forever, whilst a whole nation gloried over the deed.
"Sleep, citizens of Boulogne, all is still." The night watchman had replaced the town crier. All was quiet within the city walls. The inhabitants could sleep in peace. A beneficent government was wakeful and guarding their rest. But many of the windows of the town remained lighted up, and at a little distance below her, round the corner so that she could not see it, a small crowd must have collected in front of the gateway which led into the courtyard of the Gayole fort. Marguerite could hear a persistent murmur of voices, mostly angry and threatening, and once there were loud cries of "English spies" and "À la lanterne!" "The citizens of Boulogne are guarding the treasures of France," commented Chauvelin dryly, as he laughed again that cruel, mirthless laugh of his. Then she roused herself from her torpor. She did not know how long she had stood beside the open window, but the fear seized her that that man must have seen and gloated over the agony of her mind. She straightened her graceful figure, threw back her proud head defiantly, and quietly walked up to the table where Chauvelin seemed once more absorbed in the perusal of his papers. "Is this interview over?" she asked quietly, and without the slightest tremor in her voice. "May I go now?" "As soon as you wish," he replied with gentle irony. He regarded her with obvious delight, for truly she was beautiful, grand in this attitude of defiant despair. The man who had spent the last half hour in martyrizing her gloried over the misery which he had wrought, and which all her strength of will could not entirely banish from her face. "Will you believe me, Lady Blakeney," he added, "that there is no personal animosity in my heart towards you or your husband? Have I not told you that I do not wish to compass his death? Yet you propose to send him to the guillotine as soon as you have laid hands on him. I have explained to you the measures which I have taken in order to make sure that we do lay hands on the Scarlet Pimpernel. Once he is in our power, it will rest with him to walk to the guillotine, or to embark with you on board his yacht. You propose to place an alternative before Sir Percy Blakeney? Certainly. To offer him his life, and that of his charming wife. In exchange for what? His honour. He will refuse, monsieur. We shall see." Then he touched a handbell which stood on the table, and within a few seconds the door was opened, and the soldier who had led Marguerite hither re-entered the room. The interview was at an end. It had served its purpose. Marguerite knew now that she must not even think of escape for herself, or hope for safety for the man she loved. Of Chauvelin's talk of a bargain which would touch Percy's honour she would not even think, and she was too proud to ask anything further from him. Chauvelin stood up and made her a deep bow as she crossed the room and finally went out of the door. The little company of soldiers closed in around her, and she was once more led along the dark passages back to her own prison cell. End of chapter 23. Chapter 24 of The Elusive Pimpernel by Baroness Orzy, read for LibriVox.org by Karen Savage in February 2008. Chapter 24. Colleagues. As soon as the door had closed behind Marguerite, there came from somewhere in the room the sound of a yawn, a grunt, and a volley of oaths. The flickering light of the tallow candles had failed to penetrate into all the corners, and now from out one of these dark depths a certain something began to detach itself and to move forward towards the table at which Chauvelin had once more resumed his seat. "Has the damned aristocrat gone at last?" queried a hoarse voice, as a burly body, clad in loose-fitting coat and mud-stained boots and breeches, appeared within the narrow circle of light. "Yes," replied Chauvelin curtly. "And a cursed long time you've been with the baggage," grunted the other surlily. "Another 5 minutes and I'd have taken the matter in my own hands." "An assumption of authority," commented Chauvelin quietly, "to which your position here does not entitle you, Citizen Collot." Collot d'Herbois lounged lazily forward, and presently he threw his ill-knit figure into the chair lately vacated by Marguerite. His heavy, square face bore distinct traces of the fatigue endured in the past 24 hours on horseback or in jolting market wagons. His temper, too, appeared to have suffered on the way, and at Chauvelin's curt and dictatorial replies he looked as surly as a chained dog. "You were wasting your breath over that woman," he muttered, bringing a large and grimy fist heavily down on the table. "And your measures are not quite so sound as you fondly imagine, Citizen Chauvelin."
"They were mostly of your imagining, Citizen Collot," rejoined the other quietly, "and of your suggestion."
"I added a touch of strength and determination to your mild milk-and-water notion, Citizen," snarled Collot spitefully. "I'd have knocked that intriguing woman's brains out at the very first possible opportunity, had I been consulted earlier than this."
"Quite regardless of the fact that such violent measures would completely damn all our chances of success as far as the capture of the Scarlet Pimpernel is concerned," remarked Chauvelin dryly, with a contemptuous shrug of the shoulders. Once his wife is dead, the Englishman will never run his head into the noose which I have so carefully prepared for him.
So you say, Chauvelin. And therefore I suggest to you certain measures to prevent the woman escaping, which you will find adequate, I hope.
You need have no fear, Citizen Collot, said Chauvelin curtly. This woman will make no attempt at escape now.
If she does, and Collot d'Herbois swore an obscene oath.
I think she understands that we mean to put our threat in execution.
Threat? It was no empty threat, citizen. Sacre tonnerre! If that woman escapes now, by all the devils in hell, I swear that I'll wield the guillotine myself and cut off the head of every able-bodied man or woman in Boulogne with my own hands.
As he said this, his face assumed such an expression of inhuman cruelty, such a desire to kill, such a savage lust for blood, that instinctively Chauvelin shuddered and shrank away from his colleague. All through his career there is no doubt that this man, who was of gentle birth, of gentle breeding, and who had once been called Monsieur le Marquis de Chauvelin, must have suffered in his susceptibilities and in his pride when in contact with the revolutionaries with whom he had chosen to cast his lot. He could not have thrown off all his old ideas of refinement quite so easily as to feel happy in the presence of such men as Collot d'Herbois or Marat in his day, men who had become brute beasts, more ferocious far than any wild animal, more scientifically cruel than any feline prowler in jungle or desert. One look in Collot's distorted face was sufficient at this moment to convince Chauvelin that it were useless for him to view the proclamation against the citizens of Boulogne merely as an idle threat, even if he had wished to do so. That Marguerite would not, under the circumstances, attempt to escape, that Sir Percy Blakeney himself would be forced to give up all thoughts of rescuing her, was a foregone conclusion in Chauvelin's mind. But if this high-born English gentleman had not happened to be the selfless hero that he was, if Marguerite Blakeney were cast in a different, a rougher mind, if, in short, the Scarlet Pimpernel in the face of the proclamation did succeed in dragging his wife out of the clutches of the terrorists, then it was equally certain that Collot d'Herbois would carry out his rabid and cruel reprisals to the full. And if in the course of the wholesale butchery of the able-bodied and wage-earning inhabitants of Boulogne the headsman should sink worn out, then would this ferocious sucker of blood put his own hand to the guillotine with the same joy and lust which he had felt when he ordered 138 women of Nantes to be stripped naked by the soldiery before they were flung helter-skelter into the river. A touch of strength and determination. Aye, Citizen Collot d'Herbois had plenty of that. Was it he or Carrière who at Arras commanded mothers to stand by while their children were being guillotined? And surely it was Meunier, Collot's friend and colleague, who at Bédouin, because the red flag of the Republic had been mysteriously torn down overnight, burnt the entire little village down to the last hovel and guillotined every one of the 350 inhabitants. And Chauvelin knew all that. Nay, more, he was himself a member of that so-called government which had countenanced these butcheries by giving unlimited powers to men like Collot, like Meunier and Carrière. He was at one with them in their republican ideas, and he believed in the regeneration and the purification of France through the medium of the guillotine. But he propounded his theories and carried out his most bloodthirsty schemes with physically clean hands and in an immaculately cut coat. Even now, when Collot d'Herbois lounged before him, with mud-bespattered legs stretched out before him, with dubious linen at neck and wrists, and an odour of rank tobacco and stale, cheap wine pervading his whole personality, the more fastidious man of the world, who had consorted with the dandies of London and Brighton, winced at the enforced proximity. But it was the joint characteristic of all these men who had turned France into a vast butchery and charnel house, that they all feared and hated one another, even more wholeheartedly than they hated the aristocrats and so-called traitors whom they sent to the guillotine. Citizen Le Bon is said to have dipped his sword into the blood which flowed from the guillotine, whilst exclaiming, "Comme je l'aime ce sang coule de traître!" But he and Collot and Danton and Robespierre, all of them in fact, would have regarded with more delight still the blood of any one of their colleagues. At this very moment Collot d'Herbois and Chauvelin would with utmost satisfaction have denounced one the other to the tender mercies of the public prosecutor. Collot made no secret of his hatred for Chauvelin, and the latter disguised it but thinly under the veneer of contemptuous indifference.
"As for that damned Englishman," added Collot now after a slight pause, and with another savage oath, "if 'tis my good fortune to lay hands on him, I'd shoot him then and there like a mad dog, and rid France once and for ever of this accursed spy."
"And think you, Citizen Collot," rejoined Chauvelin with a shrug of the shoulders, "that France would be rid of all English adventurers by the summary death of this one man?
He is the ringleader, at any rate."
and has at least 19 disciples to continue his traditions of conspiracy and intrigue. None perhaps so ingenious as himself, none with the same daring and good luck perhaps, but still a number of ardent fools only too ready to follow in the footsteps of their chief. Then there's the halo of martyrdom around the murdered hero, the enthusiasm created by his noble death. Nay, nay, citizen, you have not lived among these English people. You do not understand them, or you would not talk of sending their popular hero to an honoured grave. But Collot d'Herbois only shook his powerful frame like a big, sulky dog, and spat upon the floor to express his contempt of this wild talk, which seemed to have no real, tangible purpose.
"You have not caught your Scarlet Pimpernel yet, citizen," he said with a snort.
"No, but I will, after sundown tomorrow."
"How do you know?"
"I have ordered the Angelus to be rung at one of the closed churches, and he agreed to fight a duel with me on the southern ramparts at that hour and on that day," said Chauvelin simply.
"You take him for a fool?" sneered Collot.
"No, only for a foolhardy adventurer."
"You imagine that with his wife as hostage in our hands, and the whole city of Boulogne on the lookout for him for the sake of the amnesty, that the man would be fool enough to walk on those ramparts at a given hour for the express purpose of getting himself caught by you and your men?"
"I am quite sure that if we do not lay hands on him before that given hour, that he will be on the ramparts at the Angelus tomorrow," said Chauvelin emphatically. Collot shrugged his broad shoulders.
"Is the man mad?" he asked with an incredulous laugh.
"Yes, I think so," rejoined the other with a smile.
"And having caught your hare," queried Collot, "how do you propose to cook him?"
12 picked men will be on the ramparts ready to seize him the moment he appears."
"And to shoot him at sight, I hope?"
"Only as a last resource, for the Englishman is powerful, and may cause our half-famished men a good deal of trouble, but I want him alive, if possible."
"Why, a dead lion is safer than a live one any day."
"Oh, we'll kill him right enough, citizen. I pray you have no fear. I hold a weapon ready for that meddlesome Scarlet Pimpernel, which will be 1,000 times more deadly and more effectual than a chance shot, or even a guillotine."
"What weapon is that, citizen Chauvelin?"
Chauvelin leaned forward across the table and rested his chin in his hands. Instinctively Collot too leaned towards him, and both men peered furtively round them as if wondering if prying eyes happened to be lurking round. It was Chauvelin's pale eyes which now gleamed with hatred and with an insatiable lust for revenge at least as powerful as Collot's lust for blood. The unsteady light of the tallow candles threw grotesque shadows across his brows, and his mouth was set in such rigid lines of implacable cruelty that the brutish sot beside him gazed on him amazed, vaguely scenting here a depth of feeling which was beyond his power to comprehend. He repeated his question under his breath.
"What weapon do you mean to use against that accursed spy, citizen Chauvelin?"
"Dishonour and ridicule," replied the other quietly.
"Bah!
In exchange for his life and that of his wife."
"As the woman told you just now, he will refuse."
"We shall see, citizen."
"You are mad to think such things, citizen, and ill serve the Republic by sparing her bitterest foe."
A long, sarcastic laugh broke from Chauvelin's parted lips. "Spare him? Spare the Scarlet Pimpernel?" he ejaculated. "Nay, citizen, you need have no fear of that. But believe me, I have schemes in my head by which the man whom we all hate will be more truly destroyed than your guillotine could ever accomplish. Schemes whereby the hero who is now worshipped in England as a demigod will suddenly become an object of loathing and of contempt. Ah, I see you understand me now. I wish to so cover him with ridicule that the very name of the small wayside flower will become a term of derision and of scorn. Only then shall we be rid of these pestilential English spies. Only then will the entire League of the Scarlet Pimpernel become a thing of the past, when its whilom leader, now thought akin to a god, will have found refuge in a suicide's grave from the withering contempt of the entire world." Chauvelin had spoken low, hardly above a whisper, and the echo of his last words died away in the great squalid room like a long-drawn-out sigh. There was dead silence for a while, save for the murmur of the wind outside, and from the floor above the measured tread of the sentinel guarding the precious hostage in No. 6. Both men were staring straight in front of them. Collot d'Herbois, incredulous, half-contemptuous, did not altogether approve of these schemes which seemed to him wild and uncanny. He liked the direct simplicity of a summary trial, of the guillotine, or of his own well-stage-managed noyade. He did not feel that any ridicule or dishonour would necessarily paralyse a man in his efforts at intrigue, and would have liked to set Chauvelin's authority aside, to behead the woman upstairs, and then to take his chances of capturing the man later on. But the orders of the Committee of Public Safety had been peremptory. He was to be Chauvelin's help, not his master, and to obey in all things. He did not dare take any initiative in the matter, for in that case, if he failed, the reprisals against him would indeed be terrible. He was fairly satisfied now that Chauvelin had accepted his suggestion of summarily sending to the guillotine one member of every family resident in Boulogne, if Marguerite succeeded in effecting an escape, and of a truth Chauvelin had hailed the fiendish suggestion with delight. The old abbé with his nephew and niece were undoubtedly not sufficient deterrents against the daring schemes of the Scarlet Pimpernel, who, as a matter of fact, could spirit them out of Boulogne just as easily as he would his own wife. Collot's plan tied Marguerite to her own prison cell more completely than any other measure could have done, more so indeed than the originator thereof knew or believed. A man like this d'Herbois, born in the gutter, imbued with every brutish tradition which generations of jailbirds had bequeathed to him, would not perhaps fully realise the fact that neither Sir Percy nor Marguerite Blakeney would ever save themselves at the expense of others. He had merely made the suggestion because he felt that Chauvelin's plans were complicated and obscure, and above all insufficient, and that perhaps, after all, the English adventurer and his wife would succeed in once more outwitting him, when there would remain the grand and bloody compensation of a wholesale butchery in Boulogne. But Chauvelin was quite satisfied. He knew that under present circumstances neither Sir Percy nor Marguerite would make any attempt to escape. The ex-ambassador had lived in England. He understood the class to which these two belonged, and was quite convinced that no attempt would be made on either side to get Lady Blakeney away, whilst the present ferocious order against the breadwinner of every family in the town held good. Aye, the measures were sound enough. Chauvelin was easy in his mind about that. In another 24 hours he would hold the man completely in his power who had so boldly outwitted him last year. Tonight he would sleep in peace. An entire city was guarding the precious hostage. "'We'll go to bed now, citizen,' he said to Collot, who, tired and sulky, was moodily fingering the papers on the table. The scraping sound which he made thereby grated on Chauvelin's overstrung nerves. He wanted to be alone, and the sleepy brute's presence here jarred on his own solemn mood. To his satisfaction, Collot grunted a surly assent. Very leisurely he rose from his chair, stretched out his loose limbs, shook himself like a shaggy cur, and without uttering another word he gave his colleague a curt nod, and slowly lounged out of the room. End of chapter 24.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.